Bien, nous allons continuer notre quête sur les rôles des États-Unis. Et je crois qu'aujourd'hui, cette conférence aura une portée un petit peu autobiographique. Je te cède immédiatement la parole, Rachid.
Merci, Henri. Comme toujours, bien que je parle français, je vais parler en anglais parce que c'est plus facile pour moi. Et comme M. Laurence a dit, il y a une partie autobiographique dans ce que je vais dire aujourd'hui. I'm talking today about the 1991 to 1993 negotiations that took place in Madrid and Washington. And as you'll see in the course of my lecture, I was a participant in these. So this is not just for me history. Let me begin, as I began every lecture, with a little quotation. And this is a quotation from the United States' Letter of Assurances to the Palestinians, dated October 18th, 1991. This is abridged, so it's a section from a very long letter. "We want to assure you," this is the United States speaking to the Palestinians, 1991, "we want to assure you that nothing done in this phase of the process will be prejudicial or precedential to the outcome of the negotiations. We encourage all sides to avoid unilateral acts that would exacerbate tensions or make negotiations more difficult or preempt their final outcome. The United States has long believed that no party should take unilateral actions that seek to predetermine issues that can only be resolved through negotiations. In this regard, the United States has opposed and will continue to oppose settlement activity in the territories occupied in 1967, which remains an obstacle to peace." Much like President Reagan and George Shultz before them in 1982, President George H.W. Bush and his Secretary of State, James A. Baker, saw the upheaval produced by regional war in the Middle East in 1991 as an opportunity for American self-assertion via a new initiative to resolve the Arab-Israeli conflict. This was, of course, the Gulf War that resulted from Iraq's occupation of Kuwait. It took the United States 2 months to expel Iraqi forces from Kuwait, which was done by the spring of 1991. Like the outcome of the 1982 war, this first Gulf War of 1990-91 was seen in Washington as a triumph for the United States and its allies. But it came not in the context of a revived Cold War, as in 1982, but rather in the waning days of the American-Soviet competition. Indeed, the subsequent breakup of the Soviet Empire seemed a harbinger of a changed era, one that President Bush dubbed a new world order. There were other contrasts with 1982. Israel, of course, had played the central role in the 1982 war, the invasion of Lebanon, and had played a similarly central role in the Reagan administration's vision of a post-1982 war Middle Eastern order. However, Israel had been marginal to the war over Kuwait and appeared to have a much more modest place in the Bush-Baker vision for a post-Gulf War, post-Cold War world than it had had under the Reagan administration. In service of this changed American vision of a reorganized Middle East, James Baker undertook many months of arduous Middle East shuttle diplomacy after the 1991 war. He was attempting to do what the Reagan plan had failed to do after the 1982 war. I talked about the Reagan plan in my last lecture. He was trying to cement America's place as the key Middle Eastern power through a comprehensive resolution of the Arab-Israeli conflict. The Bush administration hoped to capitalize on a number of Middle Eastern outcomes of this war. These included the participation of three major Arab states, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Syria, alongside the United States in the campaign against Iraq. They included the annihilation of most of the military forces of what had been the greatest Arab military power, Iraq. And they included the grave weakening of the PLO as a result of its having aligned itself with a now defeated Iraq. This ill-advised decision of the Palestinian leadership had profoundly alienated the Arab Gulf states on which the PLO and its constituent groups depended for much of their financing. The PLO was greatly weakened in consequence. All of these factors appeared favorable to the strategic position of the United States in the Middle East as a result of the Gulf War. However, as in the wake of the 1982 war, the profoundly flawed assumption in Washington was that a dramatic improvement, another dramatic improvement in Israel's strategic situation in 1991, resulting from yet another crushing Arab military defeat, might lead Israel to adopt greater flexibility as regards a resolution of the Arab-Israeli conflict. This drew on the long-standing, widely held, and equally flawed premise that Israeli governments could be expected to make concessions only when their country was in a position of strength. This blindly mistaken belief had led administration after administration to give Israel whatever it wanted, whatever it asked for, only to meet with unbending rigidity in its negotiating position. This post-1991 case, as we're going to see, was to be no exception, in spite of the fact that the end of the Cold War and Israel's virtual irrelevance during the war in the Gulf seemed to many to have diminished its strategic value to the United States. To their credit, Bush and Baker were attempting to exploit the unique opportunity of the end of the Cold War and this victory in Iraq to risk a major departure from earlier approaches. Indeed, they were trying to do something that had never before been achieved in the entire history of the international struggle over Palestine that began in 1917 with the issuance of the Balfour Declaration. This was to bring all the parties to the conflict together at the conference table in order to achieve a comprehensive resolution of the entire conflict. As you probably know, both Israel and American conservatives had always resisted such a comprehensive approach, bringing all the parties together. The end of October 1991, Bush and Baker achieved the first step towards this goal, convening a peace conference in Madrid under nominal American-Soviet joint sponsorship with representatives of Israel and all the most important Arab countries present. Insufficiently appreciated at the time or afterwards, this was a historic achievement in and of itself, however little may have come from it in the end. Now, the peace conference had a two-day plenary session, October 31st, 1991, and November 1st. And all that meeting and all subsequent bilateral and multilateral meetings took place on the basis of ground rules that were laid down in a letter of invitation from the two co-sponsors to all the concerned regional parties. I'm not going to read you the letter of invitation. Given the precipitate decline of the nominal Soviet co-sponsor, it's not surprising that the conference and everything that followed was under effective American management. The Soviet Union really wasn't a factor. This was shown by the separate letters of assurances that were issued by the United States alone, not by the co-sponsors, by the United States alone, to Israel, Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, and the Palestinians. I've read you from the letter to the Palestinians. This letter to the Palestinians was to take on particular importance in their eyes, and I'll talk about how important the Palestinians thought this letter was. The predominant American role was evidenced as well by the fact that after the ceremonial plenary opening session in Madrid, all the essential negotiations were to take place on a separate bilateral basis between Israel and the different Arab parties. Now, as you may know, since 1967, this had been the preferred American-Israeli structure for negotiations, Israel by itself with each Arab country. So what Baker and Bush did was they squared the circle. They had a comprehensive session with everybody, and then they broke off into bilateral sessions. Perhaps the best proof of the preeminent American position in the negotiations was that all of the bilateral sessions took place in Washington, D.C., inside the U.S. State Department and under American auspices. There was a Soviet representative there and then a Russian representative there, but they had no role. We had one meeting with the Russian in 2.5 years, the Palestinians. There was one exception, however, as regards participation in these negotiations of the representatives of all the concerned parties. The Palestinians were allowed to be represented at Madrid. This was the first time in their modern history, in fact, that they were permitted to take part in direct international negotiations with their adversaries. However, at the insistence of the Shamir government, They were neither allowed to form a separate delegation representing them as a separate people, nor were they allowed to be represented by delegates of their own choosing. The letter of invitation from the United States and the Soviet Union contained no mention of a Palestinian people. It referred simply to, quote, consultations with Palestinians and to, quote, negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians. Instead, it stated that, quote, Palestinians, you know, just some Palestinians, not specified, Palestinians will be invited to attend as part of a joint Jordanian-Palestinian delegation, end of quote, that was to be headed by a Jordanian. This was in deference, of course, to the fixed Israeli line that there was no such thing as a Palestinian people. I've talked about this before in my lectures, with a right to national self-determination and statehood in its homeland, Palestine. Again, at the Shamir government's insistence, and after months of consultations by Baker with both sides, any individual identified with the PLO was barred from the Palestinian component of this delegation, and only Palestinians from the West Bank and Gaza with no links to the PLO were allowed to take part as formal delegates. Also excluded, again by insistence of Israel, were prominent Palestinians residing in the diaspora or in Jerusalem. The latter group included Faisal Husseini and Dr. Hanan Ashrawi. In the many months of negotiations with the Americans that preceded Madrid, Husseini and Ashrawi had played the primary role as intermediaries with the ultimate Palestinian decision makers in the PLO leadership in Tunis. Nevertheless, they were excluded. This exclusion of so many categories of Palestinians was, again, a direct reflection of the deeply rooted Israeli, views. One of these views was the insistence that not only was there no such thing as a Palestinian people, for the Shamir government and for most Israelis, the entire problem was one restricted to what they called the Arabs of the land of Israel in regions that they called Judea and Samaria. Another of these views was that the PLO were no more than a bunch of terrorists who had no place at the negotiating table. And the last was that Jerusalem belonged to Israel alone, and therefore Palestinians from Jerusalem had no place in the negotiations. In response to the insistence of the Palestinians on broader representation and over the strong protests of the Shamir government, Baker finally acquiesced in a solution which involved selected individuals from Jerusalem and from outside Palestine serving as quote unquote advisors to the Palestinian delegation. I was one of these advisors, and I'll talk about my role in a minute. However, these so-called advisors could not take part in the negotiations with the Israelis. Only official Israeli vetted delegates could talk to the Israelis. In other words, the Israelis would only talk to people they agreed to talk to. They would not talk to the people chosen by the Palestinians. The official Palestinian delegates who met these restrictive Israeli preconditions were mainly individuals with no experience of international diplomatic negotiations. They also included no lawyers, by the way. There were among the advisors, as we'll see. The Israeli government was adamant in rejecting the direct participation in negotiations of the somewhat more knowledgeable and experienced advisors, who included people who were experts in international law and other things. It was not until after the defeat of Yitzhak Shamir and his replacement as prime minister by Yitzhak Rabin in mid-1992 that these debilitating restrictions were gradually lifted and the advisors eventually were allowed to participate in the negotiations. More significant in the long run than these humiliating restrictions on representation of the Palestinians was the structure of the negotiations imposed by the United States on the Palestinians alone. And this is actually very important. It sounds technical, but try and follow because it is very important. The architecture for the Madrid and Washington talks, and this continued into Oslo and continues to this day, which is why it's important. The architecture for these talks, as devised by Baker and his advisors, provided for three bilateral tracks, one between Israel and Syria, one between Israel and Lebanon, and one between the Israel and the Jordanian-Palestinian delegation. Eventually, the Jordanian-Palestinian-Israeli track was divided into two, one Jordanian and one Palestinian. It took a long time to get to that point. But whereas the Syrians, the Lebanese, and the Jordanians were meant to resolve all issues in dispute between them and Israel while negotiating the terms of a final lasting peace immediately, as soon as the negotiations started in October 1991, the Palestinians were not allowed to do the same thing. They could not negotiate peace with Israel. And I'll explain this. At the insistence of the Shamir government, and very much in line with the Begin-inspired Camp David framework. This really all goes back to Camp David. The United States imposed ground rules whereby initially the Palestinians were only allowed to negotiate what were called transitional interim self-government arrangements. The letter of invitation stated that this was because, and I quote, again, the letter of invitation from the two co-sponsors, quote, a transitional period is necessary to break down the walls of suspicion and mistrust and lay the basis for sustainable negotiations on the final status of the occupied territories. That sounds so good. This and other justifications for the transitional period proved to be patently false. It created mistrust rather than confidence, and it ultimately served the purpose of strengthening Israel's hold on the occupied territories. The talks to devise the arrangements for this five-year transitional period were supposed to be completed with 1 year. In other words, if all had gone according to plan, they would have been completed by the end of 1992. The letter of invitation stated that, quote, beginning the third year of interim self-government arrangements, unquote, or supposedly by 1995, if you follow the timetable, negotiations were to commence on what the letter called final status issues, with the aim of concluding everything, all negotiations, and achieving a peace treaty by the end of the five-year period. If all had gone according to plan, therefore, that would have meant an end to the interim period and a final peace agreement by the end of 1997. Those arrangements were supposed to end in 1997. The interim period, the negotiations were supposed to end, according to the letter of invitation, by the end of 1997. Only during the final status talks, which were to begin 3 years into the interim period, were the Palestinians finally to be allowed to deal with all of the crucial issues between them and Israel. Ending the military occupation, couldn't talk about that for 3 years. Removing settlements, control of land and water, the status of Jerusalem, the refugee issue, sovereignty, statehood, every important matter was deferred until final status. Until then, the American-Israeli imposed ground rules stipulated that all these crucial matters were off the table and could not be discussed. All that could be negotiated were interim arrangements. Now, even had everything gone as projected, this would have meant that while all the other Arab parties could immediately begin to negotiate a final peace agreement with Israel in the fall of 1991, the Palestinians were only allowed to dicker over the details of the 1978 interim self-government autonomy plan that Begin had bequeathed to Shamir and Shamir bequeathed to Rabin. But in fact, none of this went according to plan. In the meantime, the Palestinians, by making the fateful decision to accept this skewed architecture, found themselves in a straitjacket, one in which they are confined to this day, in my view. This amounted to an enormous victory for Israeli partisans of the status quo in the occupied territories. It meant that for an indeterminate period, in fact, from 1991 until today, the Palestinians would be restricted to talking about and living under the extremely low ceiling of Begin's scheme for autonomy for the people, but not the land, all the while living under a regime of continued occupation. And in my lecture last week, I talked about what Begin's scheme amounted to. So what this meant was, from being an agreement between Egypt, Israel, and the United States in 1978, 79, this became the basis for everything that has followed since 1991. This was the case since Israel could and did drag out the negotiations over the details of autonomy for many years, while thereby repeatedly postponing any consideration of final status issues, so-called, while meanwhile vastly increasing the settler population in the occupied territories. After he was defeated in the 1992 elections, Shamir said, and I quote, I would have conducted negotiations on autonomy for 10 years. And in the meantime, we would have reached 500,000 people, meaning 500,000 settlers in the occupied territories. Both this time period and the number of settlers implanted in the occupied territories have been generously exceeded by Shamir and his successors. We have 650,000 settlers today, and this process has been going on for two decades. In fact, far from beginning in 1995, the very first negotiation over final status issues only took place 5 years after that. Took place starting in July 2000 at the hurriedly convened, poorly prepared, and ultimately abortive Camp David summit, this being the second Camp David summit organized by President Clinton. The subsequent negotiations that took place in Washington and in Taba at the end of 2000 and early 2001 took place in the very last weeks of both the Clinton administration and the Barack government, and they were equally hurried and equally abortive. So there were no final status negotiations for 9 years, and when they took place, they were poorly organized and they failed. In any case, by this late stage, 10 years after Madrid, all three of the top leaders concerned, Clinton, Barack, and Arafat, had lost most of their political support and most of their legitimacy. Indeed, Clinton and Barack were out of office very soon afterwards. Moreover, the entire negotiating process was about to collapse in the violence of the Second Palestinian Intifada and Israel and the Israeli army's reoccupation of the very limited areas of the West Bank from which it had withdrawn. The Intifada was a direct result of the disillusionment of the Palestinians with 9 years of a peace process which had deferred statehood indefinitely, allowing for the consecration of occupation, the expansion of Israeli settlements, and severe new restrictions on the movement of the Palestinian population. If you're interested, I can talk to you about how much worse things got for the Palestinians during the first 9 years of the so-called peace process. They were probably one of the most disastrous periods for the Palestinians, even though supposedly negotiations were taking place and there was relatively limited violence. The grotesquely misnamed peace process that emerged from this fatally flawed negotiating structure has rolled along majestically ever since. It is still going strong. It recently entered its third decade, and it has provided glittering careers for an entire generation of American diplomats. "The East is a career," said Benjamin Disraeli. What was true of the East in the heyday of the British Empire has become true of the peace process at the apogee of the American Empire. Or, as James Baker said to Aaron David Miller, who was one of the chief officials responsible for the management of this peace process, this is Baker speaking, "I want you to know, Aaron, if I had another life, I'd want to be a Middle East specialist just like you, because it would mean guaranteed permanent employment." The East is a career. In the rest of this lecture, I will spare you the entire complex history of the series of negotiations in Madrid and Washington and elsewhere that have continued sporadically ever since and which produced a set of interim so-called Palestinian self-government arrangements that have proven long-lasting and anything but temporary. Rather, I will examine briefly the striking continuity between what preceded and what followed 1991 to 93 in terms of the ultimate acceptance by the United States of an exceedingly low Israeli-defined ceiling on Palestinian rights and expectations. Now, let me say a couple of words about my sources and about my own role here. Many of you present know that I do not come to this task solely as a historian. I was, as I've said, a participant in some of the events I describe. This started while I was in Jerusalem doing research in 1991, and Faisal Husseini asked me whether I would serve as one of a group of advisors to the Palestinian delegation should this peace conference that people were talking about take place. When Faisal asked me, to be frank, I thought there was no chance of this thing taking place, and so I said yes. I agreed to let my name be considered. I never thought anything would come of it, and I was actually shocked to get a phone call in Chicago in October saying, "The thing is on. You need to be in Amman in 2 days." I was really quite surprised. There followed 2 years, or almost 2 years, during which I served as an advisor to this Palestinian delegation, starting in Madrid in October and continuing through all 10 of the subsequent bilateral rounds of negotiations in Washington between December 1991 and June of 1993. Our role as advisors, there were a number of us, about eight or 10, three or four or five at any one time. I was in every one of these meetings. Most of the advisors were also. But there was a changing cast. Our role as advisors included helping draft Palestinian proposals, analyzing Israeli proposals, and meeting with State Department officials, all of which things I did. Towards the end of the negotiations, we were also actually allowed to participate in the talks with the Israeli side. In the course of this work, I amassed a large amount of documents, a very large number of documents. I haven't even counted them. I think there are probably thousands of them. And they are the basis for this lecture. And everything I quote from here on in is from these confidential documents that I accumulated over these two years of work. So these are unpublished. They're my own. There's no 20-year rule. I've decided to release them. So you know, you're going to get the benefit of all of that. A few episodes will suffice to give a sense of the high degree of coordination of the American and Israeli positions, which is my main theme, how closely these two countries coordinated, and how much carryover there was from what I described in my first two lectures. Two episodes, I think, set the tone very early on in this Madrid-Washington process. The first and most crucial element in American-Israeli collaboration had actually already taken place by the time we met in Madrid. And this had to do with the restrictive ground rules I've just talked about for curtailing Palestinian participation and limiting what could be discussed to a narrow question of a self-government regime for the occupied territories. As we've seen, this amounted to no more than warmed-over ideas left over from Begin's notions for the Palestinian part of Camp David. This meant continued occupation with a promise of final status negotiations at some time in what turned out to be an indeterminate future. In fact, I would argue serious final status negotiations have never taken place. We can discuss that if you want. Prepared well ahead of time, this was all that was on offer to the Palestinians at Madrid. It was reluctantly accepted by the PLO, and it became the basis of all subsequent negotiations and agreements. So the PLO rejected Camp David, but in practice, by accepting Madrid, Washington, they ended up accepting it. If we believe the accounts of a number of participants, Bush and Baker had the intention of expanding Palestinian participation and of pushing the ultimate result that emerged from the negotiating process beyond Begin's stingy concept of self-rule for the Palestinians under ultimate Israeli control, overall Israeli control. However, whatever the intentions of the President and the Secretary of State may have been, they were in the end constrained by the commitments regarding the Palestinians that had already been accepted by their predecessors in the Carter and Reagan administrations. And something else happened. It often, and this is very important, it often transpired that attempts of the President and the Secretary of State to go beyond this restrictive framework of Camp David were further sabotaged by a mode of thinking that had taken root among their subordinates, among the people who were supposedly working for them. This was premised on the idea that the United States could not, indeed must not, go beyond these subordinates' assessment, however flawed it may be, of the Israeli domestic political consensus on a given issue. In other words, the United States can't do anything Israel doesn't want, or that they thought Israel didn't want. Thus, if these officials, quite wrongly, as we shall see, determined, for example, that Israel's internal political balance meant that its government would never agree to negotiate with the PLO, then the United States could not reasonably demand such a thing of Israel. What was presumed to be acceptable to the Israeli domestic consensus often came to be seen as the limit of what the United States permitted itself to do. This delicate sensibility regarding the internal politics of Israel was directly linked to the fact that Israelis were generally seen by Americans, all Americans, as like us. They're like Americans. Israel was widely regarded as an exemplary ally. It is universally regarded in the United States as the only democracy in the Middle East. This, of course, ignores Lebanon and Kuwait, and it ignores as well Israel's many decades of military rule over millions of voiceless Palestinians. Israel was broadly admired for this and other reasons in the United States, and thus the Israeli domestic political consensus was in some measure considered sacrosanct by these officials. Such tender consideration was almost invariably absent from the way the United States dealt with other countries, including established democracies that were long-standing allies. The United States pays no attention to what Great Britain or Canada or Australia or New Zealand's domestic situation is, or France, or any other major democracy that's been an ally for decades or generations or centuries. It states its interests, it says what it wants to say, and if there's a clash, so be it. That's not what happens, at least in the view of these officials with Israel. All of this meant that Israel was clearly considered special, and this led to Israel being treated specially. Speaking of several officials, including himself, who played key roles under presidents from Carter right through Obama, in fact, from Reagan right through to Obama, Aaron David Miller, the same Aaron David Miller that I quoted Baker speaking about, said this in his book, The Much Too Promised Land. I quote Miller now. If you wanted to succeed in Arab-Israeli peacemaking, you must be an advocate for both sides. Far too often, the small group with whom I had worked had acted as a lawyer for only one side, Israel. This is Aaron David Miller speaking. Until James Baker left the State Department to run President Bush's flagging re-election campaign in the summer of 1992, Baker balanced this tendency to a large extent by providing what Miller himself called adult supervision over Dennis Ross, Aaron Miller, Dan Kurtzer, and the others. Since Baker left the State Department 20 years ago, I would argue there has never been such adult supervision at either the State Department or the White House. Partly in consequence, this partisan spirit has animated the policy of the United States vis-a-vis this issue down to this day. A second important element in the way that the United States dealt with the Palestinians in light of its relationship with Israel was summed up in how key passages of the letter of assurances to the Palestinians, which I quoted at the beginning, were ultimately interpreted by the United States government. And this is also, I think, important. One might assume, on reading it, that there was a concrete meaning to the letter of assurances warning against actions that were, quote, prejudicial or precedential to negotiations, or against, quote, unilateral acts that would exacerbate tensions or preempt their final outcome. You would assume that meant something. In the letter, this was combined with the assertion that the United States opposed, quote, unilateral actions that seek to predetermine issues that can only be resolved through negotiations. Taken at face value, these injunctions seemed to mean that the United States would vigorously oppose measures like continued settlement expansion or the isolation of Jerusalem from the West Bank that had a permanent impact on those very issues whose resolution was being postponed by American-Israeli fiat until the never-never land of final status negotiations. In other words, you would assume the United States would prevent Israel or either party from doing things that would close off options that were supposed to be left to these final status negotiations. To their lasting regret, the Palestinians assumed as much, that these assurances had meaning. Events proved that they were gravely mistaken. Now, it is true that in the fall of 1991 and the spring of 1992, the Bush administration took the unprecedented step of holding up $10 billion in loan guarantees to Israel until the United States could be assured that the money would not be used for the building of settlements in the occupied territories. This principled American action was, in fact, important in alienating Israelis from the Shamir-led hardline Likud government and in inducing them to vote in a Labor Party government headed by Yitzhak Rabin in June 1992. So this stand actually had an impact. And it provoked much self-congratulation from American officials. One of them, Dan Kurtzer, reprimanded Palestinian negotiators. I wasn't in this meeting, but I have the minutes. Reprimanded Palestinian negotiators for their ingratitude in February 1992. You have, and I'm quoting Kurtzer now from a procès-verbal of the meeting, you have only given criticism of the U.S. role instead of saying, never in U.S. history has the U.S. been so willing to take on the Israelis and been such an honest broker. The Americans almost wore themselves out, patting themselves on the back for this. But let us be clear about what actually happened. Even under Rabin, settlement expansion did not stop. Rabin's new government pledged to complete 10,000 housing units that were already underway, including in East Jerusalem. And they were allowed to do so by the Bush administration. And so the larger trend of unfettered settlement expansion and the separation of West Jerusalem, of East Jerusalem from the rest of the West Bank continued. Thus, between 1991 and 2000, while negotiations were ongoing, the number of Israeli settlers in the West Bank and East Jerusalem more than doubled to over 400,000, while Arab East Jerusalem was completely cut off from its West Bank hinterland by movement restrictions, new settlements, and a huge wall. All of this happened at the height of the so-called peace process. In spite of their occasional tough words about settlements, in the end, neither the first Bush administration nor its Democratic successor was able to give any concrete meaning to the assurances offered to the Palestinians in October 1991. Confronted with profound transformations engineered by Israel that with monotonous regularity established concrete new facts on the ground and changed the very contours of the most important issues that were supposed to be subject to negotiation, at the end of the day, the United States did nothing at all. This was for essentially the same reasons, largely related to domestic American politics and the absence of pushback from Arab states, which we have seen led the Truman administration, the Carter administration, and the Reagan administration to back off from difficult decisions on Middle East peacemaking. Whatever feeble protests about Israeli settlement expansion the US did make from time to time had no effect. They were drowned out by the incessant roar of bulldozers, cement mixers, and dump trucks building new settlements and expanding old ones all over the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem, and they were casually ignored by a succession of different Israeli governments. Israeli governments have paid no attention to whatever verbiage the United States may have produced. To their credit, the Palestinian negotiators in Washington realized very early on that something was profoundly wrong as Israeli settlement activity continued unabated, and they made attempts to redress this situation. Memos of Palestinian working meetings with US State Department personnel in December and January 1991 are replete with the insistence of the Palestinians that by the terms of reference for the negotiations, Israel could not be allowed to continue with this activity while the talks were going on. There was no response from the Americans beyond one senior State Department legal official saying in a meeting that I actually participated in, "I can't debate the logic of what you're saying. The United States opposes settlement. It's just difficult to get Israel to stop." At the second round of negotiations in Washington in 1992, Dr. Haider Abdeshefi and the other heads of the Palestinian team protested to Secretary Baker himself that Israel was refusing to freeze settlement expansion and was sealing off East Jerusalem from the West Bank. They said that it was thus acting in ways that closed off options that were supposedly to be left open, and that these actions were in violation of the ground rules for negotiations and were contrary to specific American assurances to the Palestinians. They said, we entered these negotiations on the basis of assurances from you. These are violations of them. Dr. Haider Abdeshefi, the distinguished leader who headed the Palestinian delegation, later said in an interview of his discussions with Baker, and I'm quoting an interview in the Journal of Palestine Studies that I actually had with Abdeshefi many years later. "I asked Baker how we could engage in a process when the other party was violating the basic terms of reference from the very beginning. That's where the Americans did not honor their commitments and responsibility as the party that had called for the peace negotiations. They violated their trusteeship by allowing Israel to continue to violate the ground rules that they themselves had established." This was Haider Abdeshefi. It became clear after several fruitless meetings with Baker and his aides that these protests were having no effect, and the United States would not or could not make good on its assurances and impose anything on Israel as far as settlements in Jerusalem were concerned. After consultations with the delegation, Dr. Abdeshefi flew to Tunis to put the matter before the PLO leadership. In Tunis, he recommended that there was a consensus among the Palestinian delegation that the Palestinians should suspend participation in the negotiations until the ground rules were respected. The reason was simple. They'd been invited to join in talks on what had now been proven to be false premises. The PLO decided against this course of action. It insisted on pursuing negotiations without demanding that the United States remain faithful to its commitments. This was a catastrophic mistake, in my view. With Israel able to expand its settlement enterprise with impunity and continue the absorption of what remained of Jerusalem in the absence of an effective American response, the Palestinians were negotiating from a position of even greater weakness than they originally suspected. The deal that was ultimately reached in 1993 in Oslo reflected this weakness, as well as Israel's obduracy in sticking to the original autonomy scheme of Begin. This grave PLO error in judgment allowed Israel to continue gobbling the pie whose partition the two sides were eventually supposed to negotiate. The issue of freezing settlements, as you know, is still deeply divisive to this day. It was the subject of contention between President Obama and Prime Minister Netanyahu from the moment of Obama's election until the president was forced to back down, which I'll talk about in my final lecture next week. However, what I already said in my lecture last week about the Likud Party platform of 1977, what I said last week about the first notes on settlements that were made by Begin at Camp David, and what I've said about a 1982 CIA assessment of the Israeli position should make it crystal clear that the sanctity of uninterrupted settlement expansion in Jerusalem and the West Bank was then and continues to be an absolutely immovable Israeli bottom line. No American president since 1967 has been willing or able to breach it. In the face of this rock-solid Israeli position, American determination and U.S. assurances proved to be utterly ephemeral in 1991. These assurances, as in 1982, to the Palestinians, proved to be not worth the paper they were written on. I'm referring to American assurances about the sanctity of the Palestinian camps. From that I talked about last week, from that very early point onwards in 1991, failure was virtually assured for everything built on this unstable foundation, not only at Washington, but also at Oslo and afterwards. Israel's government could, with impunity, fashion on the ground the final arrangements they desired regarding West Bank and Jerusalem, while they ensured that the endless futile negotiations of the peace process went on and on and on. These arrangements guaranteed that at least until today, there was and is no Palestinian state, there is no end to the occupation, and there is no peace between Palestinians and Israelis. Now, the negotiations I took part in produced no agreement. The agreement took place later on at Oslo as a result of secret talks, Oslo actually and elsewhere. But I think it's important to briefly examine some of the specific issues over which we had problems in Washington, because these issues were not resolved in Oslo, and they illustrate some of the reasons why Oslo failed. There's nothing surprising about the topics over which we could not agree with the Israelis from 1991 to 93. Without exception, they were related to central features of the Begin plan. One of them is that's, I think, the most revealing of the unbridgeable gap between the most the Israeli negotiators were willing to offer the Palestinians and the minimum the latter could accept was related to jurisdiction, territorial and otherwise, of an interim Palestinian authority that was supposed to emerge from the negotiations. And I'm going to talk about this because exactly the same problem emerges in Oslo, and exactly the same problem is not resolved in Oslo, and it really has not been resolved until the present day. When, after many delays, the two sides started presenting each other with proposals, the first substantive Palestinian proposal, which was put forward during the second round of negotiations in January 1992, was exceedingly clear and far-reaching regarding the jurisdiction of a proposed, and this is what it was called, Palestinian Interim Self-Government Authority, Pisgah. This is what the Palestinian paper called this authority. And the paper stated, this is the first Palestinian position paper, I quote, "It covers all the Palestinian territories occupied since 1967. The jurisdiction of the Pisgah, the Palestinian Interim Self-Governing Authority, shall encompass all of these territories, the land, natural resources and water, the subsoil, and their territorial sea and airspace. Its jurisdiction shall also extend to the Palestinian inhabitants of these territories." So the Palestinian proposal put land and territory first, and then inhabitants. By contrast, everything the Israeli side presented to the Palestinians from the very beginning lacked the central component of jurisdiction over land. Simple reference to the core Begin-derived concepts that governed Israeli thinking, concepts like autonomy for the people but not the land, explains why this was the case. Thus, one of the first formal Israeli proposals, delivered in February 1992, after the Palestinian proposal, proposed that interim arrangements, quote, must deal with people, not with the status of the territories. It further stated that, quote, the jurisdiction of what they called the interim self-governing authority organs will apply to the Palestinian Arab inhabitants of Judea, Samaria, and the Gaza district. There's no territorial scope for the jurisdiction of this authority according to the Israeli proposal. Nowhere in this Israeli document is there any mention of land or of the territorial limits of the area over which this authority would have control or jurisdiction. The accompanying letter to Dr. Abdeshefi from the chief Israeli negotiator, Ambassador Eliakim Rubinstein, was even more explicit. And this is a quote from Rubinstein's letter. "The arrangements will apply to the Palestinian Arab inhabitants of the territories under Israeli military administration. The arrangements will not have a territorial application, nor will they apply to the Israeli population in the territories." Rubinstein added tartly that the Palestinian model of January 14th, the one that I read you, quote, is a far cry from acceptable interim self-government arrangements and basically represents a Palestinian state in all but name, considered by Israel a mortal security threat, end of quote. This was a perfect illustration, these two proposals that I've read you from, of the gap between the two sides over this crucial issue of jurisdiction, and it was one that was never resolved. The Palestinians tried to craft a formula that provide the interim self-governing authority they were talking about with jurisdiction over a specified territory without crossing any Israeli red lines. We put forward proposal after proposal after proposal, in fact. So in response to Rubinstein's strictures, the Palestinians argued in early March, and I quote from another Palestinian outline for this authority, quote, a self-governing authority cannot exercise its powers for the benefit of the inhabitants without having an exclusive territorial jurisdiction, end quote. This argument for a territorial base to the jurisdiction of the interim Palestinian Authority was repeated in every Palestinian proposal made to the Israelis, and it was pressed in meetings with them. As one Palestinian negotiator stated in frustration to the Israelis in a working group during the 10th and final session of the bilateral negotiations in June 1993, I'm going to read you a very long passage because I think it sums up the Palestinians' frustration with this Israeli approach. Very simply, you have an authority which by agreement is going to be created. In our view, there can be no such thing without some geographical scope. That's all. It's inconceivable. We will never be able to explain it. We don't think it exists. We believe it's not logical. There is a fundamental difference. You seem to feel that functions can be transferred without any delineation on the ground of where those functions are. We feel that's impossible, illogical, unworkable. It's not a matter of final status. We think if you have some scope, geographic, territorial, it does not prejudge. We're not drawing frontiers, if that's what you're worried about. That's for final status. The extent of our authority has to have some geographical dimension. People won't understand it, for one thing. I don't know if you've tried to explain it to Israeli public opinion, but Palestinian public opinion will never understand. So this is a Palestinian argument. These efforts continued until the very end of negotiations, with an emphasis on this territorial approach. In one of the last sessions in Washington, in June, the very end of June 1993, the Palestinians finally elicited a semi-positive response from Ambassador Rubinstein, who asked, I quote Rubinstein from a procès verbal of the meeting, in your model, which I've been asked about by my government, in the territorial model, what will be the legal status of Israelis and the legal status of Israeli armed forces in the territories? This is actually a good question. The Palestinian negotiators in Washington recognized that this query constituted a sort of a breakthrough, coming in as it did at a session that Rubinstein himself had asked for, and since he repeated twice that he was speaking at the instructions of his government. However, all of this came too little and too late. This breakthrough, if in fact it was a breakthrough, came at a point when neither the PLO leadership in Tunis nor the Rabin government was any longer focusing on the Washington negotiations. Their back-channel contacts had culminated in January in direct talks in Oslo and elsewhere between envoys of Israel and the PLO, low-level but official envoys from both sides. And by June, these talks had already made significant progress. So when Rubinstein asked us this question, he may or may not have known, but his government knew that something was happening with the Palestinians directly. Thus, the real locus of negotiations had already shifted away from Washington by this point. I want to mention one more thing that happened in Washington, which is very illustrative of the American role, however. At another session with American officials the day previously, just before Rubinstein asked us this question, on June 22, 1993, several Palestinian negotiators, including myself, by the way, had been instructed by the PLO leadership in Tunis to communicate some of the initial understandings regarding security that they had already reached in secret back-channel talks with representatives of the Rabin government. This is before Oslo. This was not even in Oslo that these secret talks took place. And we were asked to tell the American U.S. government about some of these arrangements. The Palestinian effort provoked only consternation among their American interlocutors when they informed them, as they had been explicitly instructed to do by Tunis, that, quote, Palestinian external resources, including possibly officers in the Palestine Liberation Army, might play a role in keeping security under an interim autonomy regime. We were told to tell the Americans that the United States, that the Palestinians and the Israelis had come to an understanding on this. This caused amazement among our American interlocutors, one of whom blurted out, "Well, for the first time, we are speechless." And it really was the first time they were speechless. Ross and Miller and Kurtzer talked on and on and on normally, but they were speechless. The Palestinians present tried to reassure the Americans that there was already an understanding to this effect between the PLO and the officials who were Israeli and Israeli officials, saying, and I quote one of the Palestinians, "We think that Israeli security managers think that for things to work out, there have to be experienced and respected people who can maintain public order." The astonished response of another American was, "This security presentation is otherworldly." Now, think about it for a minute. The reason why this presentation was so hard for the two experienced American diplomats present, Dan Kurtzer and Aaron David Miller. Kurtzer ended up as ambassador to both Egypt and Israel, very senior official. Aaron Miller worked. It was so hard for them to absorb this, was that it went directly counter to their firmly fixed preconceptions and those of the entire group of American officials involved in the negotiations about the utter unacceptability of the PLO to the Israelis and the undesirability of the involvement of the PLO. The reason they didn't accept this was it went against what they had been telling their bosses for years was impossible. Israel will never accept to talk to the PLO. And here were a bunch of Palestinians telling them Israel had talked to the PLO and had agreed with the PLO on Palestinian military forces being introduced into the occupied territories, which in fact actually happened. One of the Americans, Dan Kurtzer, responded to all of this by saying, "Now I'm going to put on an Israeli hat. Now I am Joe Israeli. And I think, how is this going to affect my security?" And I say, "Forget it." This was Kurtzer trying to pose as an Israeli, put an Israeli hat on, as he put it. In face of this incredulity and this complete misreading of the Israeli scene, one of the Palestinians tried again to reassure the Americans that there were, in fact, already understandings with the Israelis on this matter, saying, "We don't think we'll have a problem agreeing with the Israelis on this." But it was to no avail. The Americans were skeptical, disbelieving, and visibly irritated. They apparently were also angry because they realized that if the PLO and the Israeli government were secretly in contact, the two parties had, in effect, gone behind the back of the United States government and cut the Americans out of the loop. For representatives of what in 1993 had just become the world's sole superpower, this was a bit too much to take. Worse for them, professionally, in doing so, the PLO and Israel had just done what these officials had believed was impossible and undesirable, and what they had been telling their bosses for years that these two parties would never do, which is to negotiate directly with one another. Of course, that is what had happened. Frustrated with the slow progress in the Washington talks under American tutelage, which both Israel and the Palestinians blamed in part on the Americans, both sides came to think that the Americans were more Israeli than the Israelis by this point. The two parties persevered with their direct clandestine contacts, reached the Oslo Accords, and eventually leading to formal recognition of the PLO by Israel. All of this, of course, was constituted major events in the history of the conflict. However, and here I want to say a few words about Oslo. I don't have enough time to say all the things I'd like to say about Oslo. I would argue, and most of us who are in Washington would argue, that the Oslo negotiators fell into traps that their colleagues in Washington had carefully avoided. This is clear if one reads the Declaration of Principles that was signed on the White House lawn in September 1993, solely in terms of the issue I've already talked about, jurisdiction. Notwithstanding the stubborn insistence of the Washington delegation on the projected Palestinian Authority's territorial jurisdiction over the entirety of the occupied territories, the negotiators at Oslo utterly failed to achieve this purpose. The Declaration of Principle reads as follows. Jurisdiction of the Council of the elected Palestinian Self-Government Council. Jurisdiction of the Council will cover West Bank and Gaza Strip territory except for issues that will be negotiated in the permanent status negotiations. Now, you have to understand what the Israelis meant by issues that will be negotiated in the permanent status negotiations. This is a term that has only one meaning in the Israeli lexicon. Settlements, military installations, land, water, airspace, and much else that would be considered final status issues were excluded from the purview of the Palestinian Authority's jurisdiction. This was just what Rubenstein had always insisted on in the Washington talks, just what we had always tried to avoid, and what Begin, in fact, had been demanding since Camp David. The DOP, the agreement signed on the White House lawn, failed to include a number of other things. These included Israeli acceptance in principle of Palestinian self-determination and statehood. Israel accepted that the PLO represented the Palestinians and that there was a Palestinian people, but it did not accept that this people had the right to statehood or the right to self-determination. So the Palestinians recognized the state of Israel. Israel never recognized that the Palestinians even had a right to a state, let alone recognizing that state. So there was an unequal recognition in the agreement signed in Washington. Israel also, the agreement also failed to include Israeli acceptance of the applicability of international occupation law, the Geneva Conventions and other law, to the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem. It failed to accept halt the settlement expansion, and it failed to accept full jurisdiction of the new Palestinian Authority. The DOP was therefore essentially little more than a gloss on the original inflexible ideas that Begin had come to Camp David with 15 years before. And I read you from his notes from Camp David, what he came to Camp David with. The main difference was that this gloss had now been accepted by the PLO itself. Now, it's true that many of these flaws were ignored by Palestinians and others in 1993 because, in certain respects, Oslo appeared to mark an achievement for the Palestinian national cause. This could be seen in the willingness of the Rabin government finally to talk directly to the PLO and later to recognize the PLO in the Oslo Accords as the representative of the Palestinian people. There's no question that this recognition signified a shift of great importance in the official Israeli position. Israel now recognized that there was a Palestinian people. Now Israel could talk directly to its main adversaries at the highest level, which in principle was clearly preferable, though in its position on Hamas, Israel has now reproduced its old position on the PLO. It won't talk to terrorists. However, Oslo did not put an end to two other fundamentally objectionable features of the Madrid-Washington process that I've already talked about. The first was, of course, Israel's refusal to halt settlement expansion, which never stopped under any government to date. This meant in practice that over the decades of the peace process, the final status of the occupied territories has not been determined by negotiations, as the letter of invitation said it should be, but rather unilaterally by Israel. The second of these objectionable features was Israel's insistence on staying within the constrictive framework of Begin's autonomy scheme. Now, many things changed when Yitzhak Rabin came to power in June of 1993, but this did not change. He stuck with Begin's scheme. So although Rabin was the first Israeli prime minister to accept that the Palestinians were a people, he never conceded that this people had the right of national self-determination and statehood. The Oslo Accords did no more than formally consecrate Begin's scheme. We've seen, I tried to argue last week, that this canny Polish-born lawyer, Begin, understood perfectly that the terms he insisted on guarantee that under no condition can a Palestinian state be created. Even worse, Oslo gave this fiendish construct, produced by the mind of the most resolute Israeli opponent of Palestinian self-determination, a seal of legitimacy with the signature of the incarnation of the Palestinian cause, Yasser Arafat himself. Now, while the Rabin government and the PLO were largely responsible for this outcome, it was also the result of long-standing positions taken by several U.S. administrations. These positions included support of an inflexible Israeli stand, which rarely wavered. I've already argued that this happened mainly because of concern about American domestic considerations, as well as the lack of pushback from the Arab side, from the Arab countries. This was linked to an excessive attentiveness to the domestic dynamics of Israeli politics, which American officials often poorly understood, and to a justified unconcern about the possible reaction of the Arab states. Americans knew that they could completely ignore the Arabs. There would be no pushback, and there wasn't. Such concern about Israeli politics was rarely matched by concern about parallel constraints on Palestinian leaders. People like Dennis Ross had no understanding and no real concern about the internal situation among the Palestinians. They were willing to put unlimited amounts of pressure on the Palestinians and paid no attention on what this might do in terms of the internal dynamics as between the PLO and Hamas, for example. They therefore, in my view, significantly contributed to the undermining of the PLO. I'll talk about this next week. This combination of factors led American policymakers to lose sight of the forest for the trees and thus to ignore the basic elements necessary for a lasting peace, even as they obsessed about details of the negotiating process. The Oslo Accords and their sequels not only did not produce peace between Palestinians and Israelis, they arguably made achieving peace much more difficult. They exacerbated the core problems at issue. They allowed uninterrupted expansion of Israeli settlements and of Israeli control of the occupied territories. Equally damaging was the fact that they served to disillusion most Palestinians and Israelis who had enjoyed a rare moment of shared optimism in the early 1990s after the opening of the Madrid Peace Conference, when it briefly looked to almost everybody in the Middle East as if the conflict might actually be on its way to resolution. Thank you very much.